Hi, I'm Cassie McCullough and welcome to Best of the Festivals on RN. In fact, the last in the series. And it explores an issue that's been running hot in recent times, same-sex marriage. Last September, the House of Representatives voted against legislation that would have allowed same-sex couples to marry. A private members' bill put forward by Labor backbencher Stephen Jones was voted down, 42, 4 and 98 against. And in the US last year, gay marriage was debated throughout the election after Barack Obama stated his support for legalising it in an interview in May. Yet there are many nuances in the arguments for and against, as we're about to hear in a discussion from the 2012 Sydney Writers Festival. On the panel, the acclaimed British author Jeanette Winterson, whose best-selling memoir about growing up and being a lesbian is called Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal? With her, the Australian writer Benjamin Law, the author and journalist Marsha Gessen, her latest book is a biography, The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin, and the fourth panellist, the pioneering champion of gay liberation, currently director at the Institute for Human Security at La Trobe University, Dennis Altman. The event was chaired by broadcaster Annette Shanwar and called Why Get Married When You Could Be Happy? A twist on the title of Winterson's memoir. It took place at the Sydney Town Hall, and a warning, some of the language used in the forum may offend.
So welcome to you all. Jeanette, since we ripped off the title of your book, we might start with you and try and get a sense on your take about this same-sex marriage topic. Do you think that legalising it would actually advance the cause of equality?
Yes, I do. I think it's essential that we have a society which is equal for all of us, regardless of gender or of faith or of sexual disposition. It seems to me to be so obvious, and it must be obvious to everybody in the audience, surely. I mean, could anybody put their hand up if they think that's not obvious?
Would anyone dare?
So it just seems a no-brainer. It's amazingly straightforward. But what I think is interesting about this is that it's really called out people's deep prejudices, nervousness around equality. It was fine when it was going to be a civil partnership. And clearly this is about much more than equal rights under the law. And now it's about marriage. It seems to be, as everybody is saying out there, the heterosexual community who's not on side is saying, well, you've got to remember that really you are second-class citizens. Marriage is for us. Now, I do understand that heterosexuals do need something for themselves. And yes. After all, we've got sex, so maybe they should have marriage. Maybe that's what it is. But I would still like to see us all taking a few deep breaths and trying to understand quite why this is producing such anger among people who are not even religious. You know, you can understand the religious groups even if you don't agree with them, but this is also producing a lot of tension amongst secular people who would think of themselves as liberal and broad-minded. So there's some quite ugly little creatures coming out of the woodwork here, and maybe this is good. Maybe it will widen into something bigger, and maybe this is just going to be a spotlight on a real problem that we're quite far away from equality.
Mm. Benjamin, you wrote recently that you'd rather be run over by a bus than marry your boyfriend. Mm. Would you care to elaborate?
That's nothing against my boyfriend. He's very handsome and he treats me very well. Look, my boyfriend and I have been together for over 10 years, which is sort of weird to talk about in public, actually, but for quite a long time. It doesn't feel like it's been that long, but if you do the maths, it has been. And I think a while back, we both talked about it quite frankly, and I think I said to him those exact words, I would rather be run over by a bus that was on fire, than marry you. And he said, and if you ever propose to me, I'll knock your lights out. It was very romantic, this beautiful beautiful moment between us. But that is a very personal thing to him and me, is basically this exchange of threats and violence. But look, I don't particularly want to get married myself, but those reasons are personal because it costs, in Australia, the average, I guess, heterosexual wedding costs $50,000 at the moment, and I can't even conceive that amount of money. I'd rather go around the world and maybe buy drugs with that money instead. But at the same time, that all said, I love weddings. I really, really love weddings. And I wrote this recently, like, it's not just the alcohol. It's the alcohol. But what I love about going to weddings with my partner is that I get to see my friends be adults and grown up and to commit their love to each other in a very public and beautiful way. And I get very emotional seeing that done. And I know a lot of my friends who are in gay relationships or lesbian relationships also do want to do the same. And I do think it's fundamentally absurd that they can't do that. On one hand, it's a very benign thing that you're asking for, the request that you want to go out there and marry the person that you love. And I think sometimes we think the symbolics of it are very, very important, but I also think the practicalities of it are very important as well. I mean, I like to travel. Maybe one day I'd like to live overseas, and there are certain rights afforded to married couples that aren't afforded to non-married couples. And I know a lot of straight people who have married not for romance, but for these practical rights, and I think those rights should be afforded to everyone.
Mm. Okay. Now, Masha, you have been married.
Right.
You've pretty much run the whole gamut, in fact. Perhaps you should tell us your experience.
I see I don't even warrant a question. Well, Ben, if you think that marriage is expensive, try divorce. I agree. It's a no-brainer that we should have the right to marry. But I also think equally that it's a no-brainer that the institution of marriage should not exist. So that causes my brain some trouble. And part of it, why it causes me trouble, is because fighting for gay marriage generally involves lying about what we're going to do with marriage when we get there. You know, because we lie that the institution of marriage is not going to change. And that is a lie. The institution of marriage is going to change, and it should change. And again, I don't think it should exist. I don't like taking part in creating fictions about my life. That's sort of not what I had in mind when I came out 30 years ago. You know, I have three kids who have five parents, more or less. And I don't see why they shouldn't have five parents legally. I don't see why we should choose two of those parents and make them into a sanctioned couple. And because between those five parents, we have two groups with two different citizenships.
You might need to take us through that. You might need to take us through that because we're getting a bit confused.
It would take
a
long time. No, I have,
You got married in Massachusetts?
I got married in Massachusetts to my partner, who's Russian, my ex-partner. And by that time, we had two kids. One of whom was adopted and one of whom I gave birth to. We broke up a couple of years after that, and a couple of years after that I met my new partner, and she has just had a baby, and that baby's biological father is my brother, my daughter's biological father is a man who lives in Russia, and my adopted son also considers him his father. So the five parents break down into two groups of three who have two different citizenships.
That's not very British.
And really, I would like to live in a legal system that is capable of reflecting that reality. And I don't think that's compatible with the institution of marriage.
Okay. Now, Dennis, one of the arguments about civil unions is that civil unions in Australia, at least, people in civil unions enjoy the same legal rights as people who are married. So is all of this really largely a symbolic kind of battle?
Look, I think it is a largely symbolic battle, but I want to make a couple of points. Firstly, I should say, before I get booed by the marriage equality people, I did actually sign the petition when there was the parliamentary inquiry, and I did it primarily because I do not want Cardinal Pell's influence to control the laws of Australia. But, okay, that's the easy applause line. What worries me about a lot of this debate is there seems to always be the assumption that somehow magically we all have long-term relationships. One of the things that for me was important about coming out as gay is we came into a community that actually accepted a whole range of different relationships, different possibilities, and the fact that lots of people are not in primary relationships, or they're in primary relationships really are quite different to those of the heterosexual norm. And the constant emphasis on same-sex marriage as the goal, the language of this is the civil rights issue of our time, it seems to me further marginalises and sends very dangerous signals to people who are not in long-term relationships and who may not want to be. For me, I really would love to see our community, and it's lovely being on a platform where I can talk about our community rather than, you know, having to debate the troglodytes who are still basically using marriage to beat us up. For me, I would love us to feel sufficiently emboldened to say we have a variety of ways of living our lives. We have a variety of ways of expressing our sexuality. We have a range of partnerships, as Marcia just explained in her own life. We should be proud of that. We don't need the sanctity of the state and the church to legitimise it. We actually do these things a lot better than Catherine and William. And when I hear people say that what they most want is to walk up the aisle or the registry office, which is even less attractive, with their partner, I think, is that all we can aspire to? Surely we can do better than that.
So, Dennis and Jeanette, you've sort of alluded to this, that there are actually more important issues that we should be talking about. Is this distracting us from the more important issues to do with equality?
No, this is an important issue. Mm-hmm. Because although I agree with you completely that we have been able to show the heterosexual community and the community at large all sorts of different ways of living, different models, which has been part of our radical input into society, and it does matter and it does make a difference. It still seems that this issue is about some deep need that people seem to have. It may not be convenient and it may not be contemporary, and we may wish it was otherwise, but people do seem to want to make that commitment, yes, to each other. And so in so much as they do, until they see the light and think they can live differently, we probably better let them.
But I'm not against that. You know, I said at the beginning, yeah, I would like to see the law change, okay? Mm. I would like to see that very unpleasant line in the Marriage Act where a celibate is required to say marriage is between a man and a woman removed, and then I would like to see the entire Marriage Act repealed. And so in that sense, but I agree with you, Jeanette, I also think one does have to pay tribute to the campaign, at least in this country, which has been one of the most impressive political campaigns. I'm now speaking as a political scientist, which I do very rarely. It's been one of the most impressive political campaigns I have seen. It has put this issue right at the front of our politics. It has converted large numbers of people, and in that sense, I agree with you. I think it has become a way of raising other issues. My concern is we're not pushing hard enough to actually explain to people what these other issues are. If the Marriage Act is changed tomorrow, kids are still going to be beaten up in schools, suicide and depression are still going to be issues. The enormous range of global inequity that Marcia could talk to us about from her own experiences is not going to be changed. And what I really would like to see is that political passion and energy and skill going into those issues as much as it is into what I think is, in the end, a nice conservative form of winning respectability.
Marsha, I'm very interested in your experience in that, as I said, you sort of run the whole gamut. When you talk about marriage, usually you end up talking about family, children, and then eventually maybe separation and divorce. And now is that sticky period, now that you, your current partner has a child, the idea of divorce from your first partner becomes a real issue, and probably compounded by the fact that you live in Russia. Right. How does all this work for you?
Right, well, here's the thing. Having entered the institution of marriage, we're now forced into a whole series of lies because we have to report to the state of Massachusetts that whatever irrevocable event that broke up our marriage occurred on Massachusetts territory, or else we will not have the right to get divorced in Massachusetts.
Oh.
But we can't actually get divorced anywhere else. I mean, this is this is a problem that a lot of American same-sex married couples have encountered. It's a lot easier to get married than it is to get divorced. Because you can go to a state to get married, and then you, when you return to your home state, or if you move to a different state that doesn't recognize same-sex marriage, it can't revoke a contract that it doesn't recognize. So there are actually, at this point, a significant number of couples in the United States who are stuck in undissolvable marriages. In our case, it's complicated by the fact that we have children. And one of the reasons that we haven't gotten divorced is because we actually have a custody arrangement that pleases everybody. You know, when my current partner was in the hospital, well, when we were both in the hospital, she was having the baby less than 3 months ago, and my ex-partner was home with the other kids. And even my current partner had to say, you know what, with three kids, you really do need three primary parents. It's very convenient, and you know, we juggle the whole thing in what I think are very efficient ways. The courts of the state of Massachusetts, like the courts of many other American states, I don't know how it works here, do not take your current custody arrangement into account. The state knows better, even though we've actually been separated for 6 years. We know exactly what we need and what our family needs in the state in which it exists now. The state of Massachusetts still knows better, and it can impose a different custody arrangement and a different income sharing arrangement than the one we have. That's the thing, is that state involvement really begins when you get to dissolving the marriage, not when you're actually entering into the marriage.
So what are you saying? Because this could not happen in that way in the UK. That if you had a perfectly amicable settlement between right. the two of you, that would be recognised and respected by the court, and there would be no further issue about it. But you're saying that in America, that is not the case.
That is not the case, yeah. The court will make its decision.
Regardless of your own wishes.
That's right.
And how
that's
amicable
right.
they are.
That's right.
That's extraordinary. Did you know that? No.
And of course in the United States, there's only some states anyway that recognise yes. legal marriage.
Yes.
Right. There's not very many, are there, Dennis?
I can't remember how many it currently is, but we've got to remember that marriage in the United States means winning a whole set of rights as a couple that we in Australia now have. And probably the most single important one is we in Australia recognise same-sex relationships for immigration purposes. And this is enormously important. We recognise same-sex relationships for superannuation arrangements. Now, I know that there will be many cases where it is difficult, but we do recognise same-sex relationships usually for healthcare, in healthcare situations. None of this is true in most parts of the US. So that I have much deeper sympathy for the American marriage movement, where they don't have the range of options we have. That doesn't mean, I mean, as I said to Jeanette, I actually do think we need to change the law, because whatever we may personally think, it is now on the agenda, and the people who are against it are not the people I suspect any of us on this platform want to be associated with. But I think it is also important to recognize that a lot of the practical reasons in other parts of the world are not important for us because we already have them.
But you're not saying, are we going to be, should we be following the Mormon line and perhaps having five marriages? Would that be better? Are we having no marriages or five marriages? Or?
Well, actually, the Mormons are just as outside the law, if not more so. You know, the polygamy is illegal in the United States. But yeah,
lots of gay people are polygamous, aren't we?
I think multiple partnerships should be possible. Absolutely. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, but usually, when we're looking at any polygamous situation, it's very bad for women in a heterosexual context because the women always suffer.
Which, of course, is not true of marriage.
It is, but it means that more women suffer. I mean, if one woman's going to suffer with one man, that's bad enough. But if he's got four extra ones suffering as well, plus his secretary.
Well, of course, then we're entering that other little tricky element that people think about when it comes to marriage, which is faith, religion, marriage as a religious institution. So what are the things we need to think about that in relation to this debate about legalising same-sex marriage? That must be another can of worms.
I don't know. This actually makes me think about the book that I've just been writing, where I went over to Asia over the course of 18 months, and I went to seven different Asian countries, and I looked at different gay issues in each of the countries. So in Burma or Myanmar, I looked at HIV/AIDS. And in China, one of the things I looked at was marriage. And, you know, China isn't an especially religious country, so to speak, but marriage is a huge sort of sticking point over there for young gay and lesbian people. And what you're actually finding is that it's not religion that's actually forcing these people into, you know, not thrusting them into marriage, but familial expectations, and not just expectations from the parents down, but expectations of themselves as well. So when we talk about gay marriage in China, especially you know, throughout the metropolitan cities, where there is a burgeoning gay consciousness, is often a case where gay men will look online for lesbians to marry for convenience, to be able to show that their parents that they are married and they're fulfilling their filial expectations. But it's so interesting for me when I went over there that in my mind the gay marriage issue was one thing. In another country it's a completely different thing, where they they're still entrenched in this idea that marriage is between man and woman. So that when people come out often as gay or lesbian in China, their parents' reaction is, okay, that's weird, but you're still going to get married, right? And what they're meaning is married to someone of the opposite sex. So that's the first thing that comes to mind for me.
It's kind of traditional, though, the idea of marriage as being an arrangement of convenience. Mm. And it's going back to that original idea of what marriage was about, really. It wasn't a romantic union. It wasn't about love. It was a very pragmatic kind of thing,
about partnership, property.
Property, all that sort of thing.
This is Best of the Festivals here on RN. I'm Cassie McCullough. We're listening to Benjamin Law, Marsha Gessen, Dennis Altman and Jeanette Winterson with Annette Shunwar at the 2012 Sydney Writers' Festival, discussing the subject of gay marriage in the panel Why Get Married When You Could Be Happy. And as you'd expect from the subject, there's a lot of talk about sex and some explicit language. So either you'll want to turn your radio off now or turn it up.
This is a topic about marriage. It's not really about sex.
No, I'm fascinated by how reluctant the people who argue vehemently for same-sex marriage are to talk about sex. The original concept of marriage in the Western world, of course, was based heavily on the idea of monogamy, really so that the man could be guaranteed that the children were his, and there was no, you know, he couldn't have cared less whether his wife had any sexual pleasure or suffered or whatever. The point was you got married and that way you continued the male line. Now, I'm going to speak now as a gay man, and one of the things about gay male culture is that it is not a monogamous culture. And all the evidence we have suggests that monogamy is a myth. that there are virtually no, there are many long-standing gay relationships. There are virtually no long-standing monogamous gay relationships. I happen to think this is a good thing. I happen to think this actually puts sex in a much better perspective than the concept that we're being fed. But I do get very anxious when I'm told that people want to have a marriage which is exactly the same as the ones that their heterosexual sisters and brothers have, when their heterosexual sisters and brothers are signing up for, whatever they do in practice, a belief in lifelong monogamy. Mm. And to me, that is, there's a level of hypocrisy in that. That is built into the marriage ceremony that I do not want to see replicated.
Mm. I don't think that's quite right, though, is it? I mean, when you say the marriage ceremony, do you mean the religious ceremony or the civil ceremony?
Well, civil ceremony, you can have a number of variations.
So are you saying that is the hypocrisy built into the religious ceremony or in the concept of marriage altogether?
You know, I would love to have the people who are out there arguing for same-sex marriage say, let's be clear, marriage is about primary emotional commitment to another person, and it doesn't mean I won't fuck around. And that's what most of us mean when we talk about our relationships. And I think it would be really helpful if the same-sex marriage movement had enough guts to say that. Because what I see going on very much, I think there's a difference, Jen. You said right at the beginning that lots of liberals are disturbed by marriage and people get upset and angry. My experience in Australia is that well-meaning, quite conservative, well-meaning people are very strongly supportive of same-sex marriage because they see it as taming us. And remember, there are lots of gay, in the United States, if you look at the literature, there are lots of gay men who are now arguing the real reason to encourage gay men to get married is they're going to be monogamous and that's going to help control HIV. And, you know, I could point you to the literature where this is being argued very strongly. Now, I don't want to buy into an argument that a 23-year-old should be told, you're going to get married and this is the only person you're going to have sex with for the rest of your life.
What does Australian law actually say about this? Because I know that in many American states, adultery is cause for divorce.
Yes.
Right? I mean,
and remains so in Australia as
right.
well.
Right, so it's not a question of the ceremony. You're actually signing this up. It's in the contract, you know.
Yeah, pretty much. It is, isn't it?
Well,
Dennis?
Except we do have no fault divorce, so I think.
Yeah.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because some American states don't.
We need a lawyer on this platform. We have many in the audience, but they will correct us.
Yes,
to use no-fault divorce, both parties have to agree.
But yes.
One party can file for divorce on the basis of adultery, right?
No.
Okay. So no. you can do that in the States.
It's very worrying what you can do in the States, isn't it?
Yes, I think we can all agree on that. That could be the unanimous conclusion of the panel.
But, you know, I think there is an issue because you're right about, certainly about the gay male culture not being monogamous and why should it be, and the whole troubling question of monogamy, whether it's natural, you know, what everything in society seems to me to be propositional. Mm. But then what are we talking about? Because I think that what you expose is something which is very uncomfortable for the male heterosexual or homosexual. I mean, heterosexual men would prefer to screw around if they could, I think, mainly.
There's some applause.
But
and so would many heterosexual women.
Maybe so. I think there is a difference, though. You see, one of the things that I worry about is that we're going to have an over-masculinized culture, in that we're always going to take the values of the male as the dominant value. And I am not sure that women necessarily feel this way, which is not about anti-sex or less sex, but I think it's about a deep unease about endlessly separating love and sex. You see, you think it's a good thing. I'm not sure it is. And that's a much bigger argument about whether these separations are actually good for us as human beings. They might be good for our libido. They might be good for our self-esteem. They might be good for something. But whether they're actually good for us as human beings, I don't know. I mean, this is a conversation I have with my partner, not about monogamy, but about what allows you to deepen and grow as a person as you pass through life. Because what you are at 23 should not be what you are at 73.
Hmm. Yes.
So, but I think if anything, that's an argument against having a standard contract.
Yes, it is.
Mm-hmm. And it's an argument for couples, when people form couples, to encourage them to develop their own set of rules and understandings that are not constrained by external legal barriers. And I do find something odd that we require legal permission to get married, but not to have children. And if you think about it, the choice to have children is actually a much more important choice because it involves the fate of other people who are totally dependent upon the parents.
And that's the interesting thing about this very popular move at the moment, you know, for legalising marriage, is it doesn't go beyond, you know, the wedding day. The debate does not go any further than
that. I don't think they can face going beyond. I mean, they can't even get to the wedding day, can they? I mean, sort of what might come after. I mean, the whole place is having a nervous breakdown out there.
And it is the old, you know, Prince Charming and the princess, you know, marrying and ending up happily ever after, riding off into the sunset. And I'm thinking that if we do change our attitudes, if marriage is not monogamous, well, then that's like 80% of all television drama and movies, they're just going to have to change their plots.
No, but there's always the second series.
I think often, though, you know, a relationship, this is not true in the gay male community as far as I know, and you'll correct me if I'm wrong about this, but having sex with someone who's not your partner is not a signal that there's anything wrong with your primary relationship. Yes. But very often, it is a signal of that, you know, both in the heterosexual community and wider. You know, it's often that there is some breakdown of, it's not about desire, there's often some breakdown of intimacy or some wish not to put the work in there. I mean, look, if we all had sex with somebody else tonight, it'd be much more exciting than if we went home and had sex with our partner, probably. But that does not mean it's a good idea. At least it may be a good idea for us. This is what I was talking about with the question of what happens over the course of a life, which has become very interesting to me as I get older, because I used to like lots and lots of sex and I didn't particularly rate monogamy as a good idea. And I think it wasn't. But what's happened to me later is now I'm trying to find out about something different. I'm trying to find out about something in my relationship, in myself, that I want to explore, and that's up to me and to my partner. And what I worry about is that often the gay male culture has segued into the obsession with youth that's in the general culture now, you know, just go out there, you know, don't have any ties, just go out there and have a good time.
Twink night, Thursday night.
Twink night, Thursday night, yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't want to make gender assumptions, but I do think there seems to be a profound anxiety for the male about aging, which is projected onto the female. So we're carrying it. And, you know, and you see it in gay culture as well, there's the older man, the younger man thing. And I know so many gay men who are terrified of getting old because they won't be attractive, they won't be able to pull the boys, they won't be able to go out to the clubs, and they won't have anybody to get old with. And I find this as a huge anxiety among a lot of the men that I know who thought it was fantastic and then all of a sudden thought, shit, I'm going to die on my own.
But, Jared, I think there are two separate issues, because I think the anxiety of not having someone to grow older with is a very real and deep anxiety that I think cuts across gender and sexuality. But, and I'm the oldest person on this panel, I hate it. I used to be the youngest person on the panels, and then something happened. I think the two are quite separate. That is, your intimacy, your relationship, I've been in a relationship of 23 years, that relationship and that intimacy grows and changes and develops. It doesn't seem to me that it's altered in fundamental ways by sexual monogamy. I think that fidelity, which we tend to define in sexual terms, should be redefined. Fidelity is about a much deeper commitment. And I think that you're quite right. I mean, I think I'm not going to disagree. You are pointing to some aspects of gay male culture that most of us would probably agree are not particularly attractive. They're also shared by mass media culture and the way that young girls are increasingly sexualized, right, as objects for older men. But I think we can differentiate between intimacy, companionship, commitment on the one hand, and what people do sexually on the other. And again, I'm saying, look, what I'm really saying is we have now in this country an extraordinary powerful movement that has raised this question onto the political agenda. And as I say, I really congratulate the people who've done it. Let's use it now for these sorts of discussions rather than, as Annette said, for a discussion that sort of ends on the wedding day. Mm. People have spent the $50,000 that Ben doesn't want to spend and we don't talk about what happens thereafter.
Can I raise something controversial? There is, I think, a sort of blessing in having had an absence of the idea of same-sex marriage. I mean, and that might seem weird, but I'm 29 and homosexuality was only decriminalised in Queensland, my home state, about 21, 22 years ago. So that's within my lifetime. So the whole idea of same-sex marriage, I think, is almost fantastic to me, how quickly it's built up steam. And although every fibre in my body would love to have it legalised, because I just think it's a sort of boring issue that just needs to be pushed through so we can talk about different things almost. We're talking about contracts, essentially. And I just think once we get over this, we can talk about much more interesting things like sex, you know. Dennis and I will talk about that later. But one of the things that I actually like about not having had same-sex marriage in my imagination as a child was when I became an adult and I entered into relationships with people, it's a complete negotiation of your roles and that expectation of what marriage is. You do this and you do that, and this is how our sexual relationship works as well. Those expectations have to be built from the ground up in a way, and I've actually quite appreciated that process, being a young gay person, about, well, what are our boundaries, and thinking of all the other gay male couples I know, especially, and gay female couples, the ways in which everyone has mapped out their terrain has been very, very different. Some have veered very, very close to marriage, and these are often the couples who will get married once it becomes legal, because it is inevitable. I mean, over 80% of young people between, I think, the ages of 18 to 24 in Australia want it legal, and old people die. So, of course, it's on its way. I'm sorry. It's just going to happen sooner or later. But I think in the meantime, like, I'm thinking of one couple that I know who are Australian, and but they spend most of their time overseas, and often they're apart. So they've, you know, this gay male couple have built up rules for each other. They are married. Like, I think they married in the UK, and but if you go past a certain amount of time apart, it is assumed things will happen. But they don't talk about them, and you don't get emotionally involved. So those are the ground rules, and I think that's really interesting that. You know, for instance, one of the biggest gay marriage advocates in the States is Dan Savage, who is very much for gay marriage but isn't a huge fan of monogamy. And I think that those sort of different options need to be discussed, and maybe homosexuals can teach heterosexuals about that as well.
I agree. And I have this weird life where I spend most of my time in a country that passes laws against homosexual propaganda, and where imagining same-sex marriage on the political agenda is just impossible. And I also carry a U.S. passport, and I'm quite involved in partly living in the States as well. And it's like time travel every time. And one of the things that I feel when I engage in this time travel is what the United States and what Western culture in general gained in the sexual revolution. Because when I go back to a country that didn't have a sexual revolution, which is Russia, there's an incredible number of assumptions, and this just what you were talking about, that any relationship is a potential lifelong partnership, that you don't talk about anything, that sex and monogamy and all sorts of things that happen in a relationship are not subject to discussion or negotiation. And I think what we gained in the sexual revolution was the understanding that relationships could take many, 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 many different forms. And for that reason, I'm so resistant to this whole discussion of marriage, because it's so reductionist. It's like all the stuff that we came up with, all the stuff that we learned to do, all the stuff that we learned to talk about is going to be packed back into this contract that is not inadequate for the purposes that it's supposed to serve.
But do you think that will happen, or may it not be that this will blow it apart? That once we get in on the act, whole thing will have to change so dramatically. Partly because we'll all think, hold on a minute, that was nice, but actually, you know, this really needs fixing. So we might...
That's the problem with the political debate. I don't know, again, how it happens here. Certainly the way that it works in the States is that part of the message on the pro-gay marriage side is, don't worry, marriage will stay exactly the same as it is. It's just that gays and lesbians will have access to it.
Mm, no, that's never going to happen, is it?
Yeah. Right.
But there is something that I want... I mean, I have no answer to this. It's a question that I'm asking myself, so you can all help me with it and so can the audience, which is this, that, you know, whenever there is a zeitgeist moment, you always look underneath it to see, well, is it about politics? You know, what is it about? And I'm just wondering if the business of marriage and this great desire for marriage has anything to do with wanting to make some sort of sacred space or spiritual space, because you just said now, you know, it's all about contracts. But maybe that's the problem. Maybe it isn't all about contracts. And maybe we feel, because everything in life now is on the outside, and it's, you know, we are a very secular society, aggressively so, perhaps we're trying to reintroduce some sort of sacred dimension, some spiritual dimension to this, and say, no, it is more than a contract. And even though here in Australia, where I believe you do have equal rights, which is not the case, you know, in Britain or certainly in America, still there's this push for wanting marriage, which suggests to me that the mystery of the word, you know, it was always meant to be, wasn't it, the mysterious union as well as a property act, you know. And I don't think that was just decoration. I think it was an acceptance that there is such a thing as a soul and that you can share it. That maybe in there is something that we're after. I'm not sure. This is just something I'm asking myself.
Can I suggest there's something? I mean, that may be true, but I think there is something else as well.
No, I want you to answer that.
Jeanette, I am the last person to ask questions about the spiritual because I don't have any sense. I have no desire for the spiritual. I'm going to agree with you that it's not purely about a contract. But what I think it's about partly is a desire to be reconciled with one's biological family. Because I think that, I mean, for my generation, coming out, however accepting and tolerant your family may have been, still represented a break with the family. And I think Ben's referring to that very strongly in terms of, you know, your experiences in Asia, where there's absolutely still the case. And in any Asian country I've been in, that is the huge dilemma for anyone coming out as homosexual, woman or man. So I think that it's not so much a desire for a spiritual space, it's a desire to integrate our sexuality into our biological families and to heal what for my generation really was a great fissure, that we often did feel we had to make that choice. And, you know, we still hear many stories of people who are alienated forever from their parents, their siblings, etc. And I think in that sense, it's not spiritual, but I recognise it is a desire that goes far beyond just a contract or just beyond legal equal rights.
You don't believe in soul to soul, Dennis?
No, but, you know, while Ben and I are talking about sex, you and I can talk about the spirit.
I think a lot of this has to do, and this sounds really crass, but I think a lot of it has to do with people wanting to throw in an awesome party. You know, like I think of all the heterosexual weddings I've been to, I should just say weddings because they've all been heterosexual, and so much of it has been about investing into a project, and I think gays are pretty good at projects. So I think a lot of them see this as this invitation to participate in something that's actually quite fun as well, you know, that this is sort of something that you can kick your heels up in and plan towards. And I think a lot of us, even if we didn't think of ourselves as entering into something that's gay marriage. I think most of us grew up with the idea that marriage was something to aspire towards. I think I did. And the idea that you'd get to a stage where you'd be with someone and all the ceremony and pageantry that comes with it. I don't think you ever quite shake that. And maybe that's a part of it as well, the narrative we've built in our head. But I don't think that's a bad thing.
It mystifies me because it seems to me that marriage does seem to be kind of an anachronism, you know, it's a flawed institution, doesn't seem to work. There are so many divorces and separations, we now have so many blended families. It just doesn't, you know, it mystifies me why it is still so desired. And a lot of my nieces and nephews' generation in the 20s and 30s, they all want to get married because it's their one chance to be the star of their own video and to be on the red carpet. But other than that, you know, why buy into what does seem to be so out of date and flawed?
So do you think if everything was equal, that whole push would go away? It isn't going away, though, is it?
No, it isn't going away. I think it's, you know, as Ben says, it's all going to happen. It's all going to pass through. So what will it look like then, you know, if legalized marriage happens here, if President Obama gets back in and things start moving in the States, well, it's probably not going to be quite that smooth.
Hang on, let's not get carried away with President Obama. He has not suggested any legal change whatsoever. In the United States, marriage is a matter of state law, and President Obama has been very clear that he is not going to campaign to change the law of a single United States state. And it is, I find it bizarre, this constant evocation of President Obama making, yes, he made a nice statement, but that is not going to change the situation. He made that statement in the same week as the state of North Carolina passed a referendum outlawing same-sex marriage. Well, it'll happen here before it happens there. That's a prediction I'd certainly make.
It is within the purview of the federal government to recognize gay marriage, same-sex marriage, on the level of federal taxes, which is important, and immigration rights, which is hugely important.
And I don't want to discount totally what Obama did, because as much as this discussion, debate is symbolic, it is also about practicalities as well. And I think it does take political bravery still to get up and say, I personally support gay marriage. And I think for a lot of people, a lot of my friends, that actually did mean a lot, because, I mean, we get that from some MPs here, but we certainly don't get it from our Prime Minister.
Look, on that note,
can you ask how many people in this audience are married?
I'd actually quite like to bring the lights up and I'd like to involve the audience in the conversation, which is how many of you in the audience are married?
Congratulations.
That's about a third? A third, would you say?
And how many of you would like to be married?
More.
How many of you would like not to be married?
A whole lot more.
Was there any overlap?
How many of you just raise your hands who are actually married now?
All right, well, we've got lots of questions. Let's start with microphone one.
Oh, hi. Do you think this whole push for marriage is almost like persecuting singledom, especially with the tax code, pensions and that kind of thing? I just feel as though being single in today's society, especially for a woman, is just sort of not acceptable and you can't do it. And yet, the majority of people are going to be single.
I actually do think that is a really important and serious issue. And it's not just the issues you're referring to, it's the psychological pressure where I think we are creating a situation for young lesbians and gay men that they are going to feel they've failed if they don't have... You know, there's this constant talk about we want to walk down the streets hand in hands with our lover, but you have to have a lover first. And I think we forget that.
Thank you for a very fascinating panel discussion. It's really, really been very engaging. I guess my question is around the gay community and changing attitudes. So I know there were quite a few points alluding to the fact that the gay community is polygamous or not committed for a lifetime. But is the drive for same-sex marriage not a evidence or perhaps a suggestion that the gay community is changing. I guess I'd take issue with the view that, you know, all gay people are the same and struggle to commit over the long term. And perhaps it's even possible to take one step further, because men are from Mars and women are from Venus. But if you have two people from the same planet, maybe they're more likely to get along.
I like that a lot.
And I'm saying that, and I think Jeanette and I have a different view of this, and it's a really interesting discussion, that I'm arguing that commitment should not be measured primarily by monogamy. That's all I'm trying to say.
I think separations have become very fashionable, and I am not sure that it helps us as human beings to be endlessly separating off emotion and sexuality. Well, that's all.
Thank you for your question.
Thank you.
I get incredibly pissed off that real issues about human rights are bumped off the front page by this argument. I'm talking about how we treat people seeking asylum, how we treat people like my mother, who at 88 is looking at moving into retirement homes, and how we fund aged care, how we treat people with disabilities. I would like to ask you, is there a risk that this argument is going to become humorous and is going to piss people off like me, who support gay marriage but who are annoyed that real issues about true rights are being knocked off the front page?
Okay.
Well, I did think that gay marriage was a real issue.
I would also reframe it and say, if that's what you believe, isn't this extra incentive to rush it through? To get it out of the way.
Get on with the real stuff.
We sort of have to rush through too, unfortunately. So will you please thank our panel, Jeanette Winterson, Benjamin Law, Marcia Gessen, Dennis Altman.
Annette Shunwar bringing that forum to a close at the 2012 Sydney Writers' Festival. On the panel, Dennis Altman, Director of the Institute for Human Security at La Trobe University, the British author Jeanette Winterson, journalist Marcia Gessen, and Australian writer Benjamin Law. You can find details and the audio on the RN website, abc.net.au/radionational, and follow the links to Best of the Festivals. And that's it for Best of the Festivals for now. Next week, RN returns to regular programs for 2013. And at 6 p.m. each weekday evening, it's Drive with Waleed Ali and Julian Morrow on Friday Drive. I'm Cassie McCullough, and this year you'll find me and Jason DeRosso co-hosting The List, a weekly look at the weird and wonderful world of popular culture. Sometimes it's deeper than you think. Everything you need to know about popular culture, and quite possibly a little bit more. The List, Fridays at 5:30 p.m. and again at 11 on Sunday mornings. For now, have a great evening.